to another edition of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your host, L. Ariel, and we can be found at musicjobspodcast.com. That's musicjobs with an S, podcast.com. We're also on all the streaming platforms, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Android, and more. And just a favor to ask, if you are listening to us on one of those streaming platforms and you see the stars, if you can give us some stars, give us some love so we can move up in the rankings and get this podcast to more people who are interested in a career in music, who are interested in a job in the music industry. Again, we are all about the movers and shakers and innovators in the music industry. We're all about getting the facts about the music landscape today, how to be successful, how to navigate, and this podcast is all about picking the brains of those amazing people that work in the biz and finding out how they did it, how did they get to where they were at, and what kind of experience, insight, advice, and wisdom they can share with all of us. Last week, I had the pleasure of interviewing Lucy Woodward, a really, really talented, successful singer-songwriter, vocalist, entertainer, performer. She has performed with Rod Stewart, Pink Martini, Snarky Puppy. She is a pop star in her own right. She had a pop hit called Dumb Girl. She also wrote There's Gotta Be More to Life for Stacey Arrico, which was a top five hit. So just a lot of amazing experience. She's now moved into the jazz, R&B, blues demographic and is touring worldwide and doing all these jazz festivals, and just great, great story, and how those two demographics are different and marketing to them, et cetera, et cetera. So just really, really good stuff. Be sure to check it out, and be sure to check out all the other good episodes that are on the website or the streaming platforms. Okay, my next guest, I'm really excited, is Naima Cochran. She has so much knowledge and so much insight about the music industry. I really think you're going to enjoy this interview, and you're really going to get educated. She actually started her career in entertainment law and then went over to Bad Boy. She's worked at Arista Records, Columbia Records, and Epic Records in the marketing department, and now she's part of John Legend's management team. She really knows what's going on in the music industry, what the landscape looks like, where we are headed, and she's also the founder of Music Sermon, which I found on Twitter. It's an incredible experience, but basically, in a nutshell, it is this incredible platform that she's created that's all about highlighting the underappreciated and often overlooked artist songs and subgenres of urban music. Let's kick things off with one of Naima's favorite songs, Janae's Sending My Love. Joining me on Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am so, so happy that you could be here today.
Thank you for asking me to be here. I'm glad to share a little bit of my own journey in hopes that it'll help somebody else.
Yeah, love it. So let's go way back, or maybe not too far back. let's talk about childhood. Tell me about the kind of household you grew up with in terms of music.
Well, I grew up in a, I feel like this probably sounds cliche, but I did grow up in a very musical family. I'm actually named after a song by John Coltrane on his Love Supreme album. No, on the Giant Steps album. On the Giant Steps album.
Oh,
and it's called Naima. Obviously, it was written for his second wife. And my father was a tenor saxophone player, so a huge Coltrane fan. So I'm named directly after that song. My father's side of the family, full of musicians. My uncle was in the Commodores for a brief period of time. My grandmother had her MFA in music composition. One of my cousins teaches music theory, graduated from Berkeley, and plays with like Branford Marcellus and all sorts of stuff. So we have a family history of musicians. And on my mother's side of the family too, even though there aren't as many players, aside from everybody growing up playing piano, still a lot of music lovers in the family. So I grew up in a house surrounded by music at all times. All my parents, friends, all my family members. And I didn't have any formal training per se. I played the violin in school up through the end of high school. I was first chair, first violin.
Oh, wow.
And I sang in my college gospel choir, and I sing in the choir at my church. So it's always been the medium I connect with the strongest, I guess in part because I just grew up surrounded by it at all times.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, was that, this might sound like kind of a weird question, but was that almost difficult for you in terms of, because I think sometimes when people can be so immersed in something, like they'll go through like teenage rebellion or something and try to go in an opposite direction. Did that ever come across your mind, or were you just like, this is in my DNA. I really don't have a choice.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know that I think maybe it had more people in my family have been professional musicians. Maybe I was going in a different direction, but it was really just more about the love. And those were always my things, reading, writing music, any kind of content. So I honestly didn't even set out to have a career in music. That kind of happened by accident. And I'm the only person in my family that has a music-related career that isn't a musician and who does it on the other side in terms of like, I don't create music, but I work with musicians and work with artists. But it happened by accident. It wasn't intentional. But no, there was never a thought where I was like, I'm not going to do anything with music because everybody does something with music. It wasn't that. In fact, most of my family is still full of professionals of some sort. So the fact that I work in entertainment, that in and of itself was actually a little bit rebellious. Like, I'm not going to get this. I mean, it's a real job, but you know, like I'm not going to, instead of going to law school, I'm going to go work for a record label. And I was kind of like, okay, you know, right. that might've been my bit of rebellion.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. So why don't you talk a little bit about that? What did you decide to do, you know, after high school and sort of your life was in front of you? Which direction did you decide to go?
Well, I think what's important to say is that now so many colleges have music programs and music business programs and music marketing programs and entertainment programs. And when I went to school, that wasn't a thing yet. I graduated from high school in 93, and that just wasn't something that you went to school to do. The marketing that you studied back then in school was more of like a business marketing. It was more about analytics and data research, and which entertainment marketing is completely different. So you kind of didn't even know what jobs were available to you working in a record label if you didn't have some proximity to it. And I don't know anybody who, when I was coming up to school, was like, I'm going to work for a record label. Some people were trying to work as artists, but not necessarily trying to work on the business side. So my intention had always been to go to law school. I started thinking of entertainment law, and I went to work at an entertainment law firm. In fact, I worked, the law firm was called Osea. It was two law firms in one office, Osea and Woods and Middleton and Niles, and the two partners in Osea and Woods, Ed Woods and Reggie Osea. Reggie Osea, who's now better known as Combat Jack, they both just recently died in December. So I went to work there, and that was enough for me to realize that I really loved the business, and I loved the energy, and I loved all the action and excitement around it, but I didn't want to be bogged down with the paperwork. I wanted to be on the creative side. So at first I thought that meant I wanted to be an A&R because that was one of the only jobs I really knew about in music. So I went to intern at Bad Boy, and I interned with the head of A&R. And I was like, okay, no, this isn't it. And with my next real job, I went to Arista Records, and I was working with the VP and the director of urban marketing. And that was where I was like, oh, this is me, because I could interact with the artists. I could hear the music early. I could strategize. It allowed me to write. It allowed me to create. It allowed me to come up with ideas. So it allowed me to tap into all the different things I love to do. And when you sit in the marketing seat, you are touching every other, you have a view of, and you're touching and you're interacting with every single facet of the label, from retail to publicity to radio to video. And that's, it's one of the only positions from which you do that, and where you really see how all the different elements work together. So that's where I realized that this is where I belong. This is my niche. And from then on, after Arista, I left the label side for a little while and worked in event production. But then when I came back, Columbia Records and then Epic Records, I was still always in marketing, in like a marketing director, marketing manager. And now for the past 2 years, after forming a relationship, because you're kind of, when you're a, some people call it product manager, marketing manager, whatever, project manager. When you're that person in the label, you kind of are the in-house management for the artist, and you tend to develop a very close relationship with the artist, or at least with their teams. And based on the relationship I developed with John Legend, I was his marketing manager at Columbia. I ended up eventually now going to work for with him on the management side, and that's what I've been doing for the past 2 years.
Wow. So just to back up a little bit, that's a hell of a lot of stuff going on. It's amazing. I love it. I love it. Just to unpack it a little bit, because I'm sure people would be interested. How did you get the internship at Bad Boy? Because and would you say that's sort of the best way to kind of get your foot in the door is an internship?
Absolutely. I got it based on my relationship. We represented, at the time, the law firm I worked for represented all of the Bad Boy's hitmen producers, which was the name of the production squad who did basically all of the hits in the late 90s to early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And one of those producers was Harf Pierre, who was also the head of A&R for Bad Boy. Now I think he actually is still the president of Bad Boy. And I literally just called Harf and said, can I come intern with you? But the point of that is that it was based on relationship, right? It's not as easy to just call somebody up now and say, I want to intern for you, because there have been a lot of more rules and regulations put in place about what internships can consist of and what the process is to bring interns on board. And now you have to be able to get a college credit most of the time. And there's some other, you have to be able to get a letter from your school. Back then, you could probably just walk in and just be there. And that kind of changed because a lot of people were using interns as like glorified gophers. It's like, go to the store, go do this, go do that. And there wasn't like a structured program of learning and shadowing. Fortunately, that wasn't necessarily my experience. But what I can share is that as you're coming, as you're kind of growing in this business and you meet people, what I'm finding with people who are trying to break into the industry now is that social media kind of gives you an illusion of closeness to certain people. So it's very much like, I'm going to DM this person, or I'm going to tweet this person, or I'm going to hit this person. I'm just going to ask for something off the top without giving them any reason why they should do it, or what I'm about, or what's special about me, or what my strengths are. And it's very just kind of, can you hook me up, or just give me a shot? But like, why? You know, like, you have to still be able to tell a person. I was able to call Harv and say, can I come intern for you, because I had a relationship with Harv. He knew where I've been working. He knew what I've been doing. And you have to nurture and develop relationships with people. And I find that that's kind of a step that seems to be missing now. And that would, if anything, that's the step that I would encourage, even aside from whatever your grades are, whatever your, you know, area of study is, as you're meeting people, as you're coming into contact with people, as you're at networking mixers and you're able to exchange cards or do whatever, if you're in town, say, can I buy you a coffee? Say, can I just ask you a little bit about your path? Find out about the person and see what they have to share with you before you ask them for something. Before you're saying, can you just give me a job? Maybe start with, how did you get your job? Right. What did you have to go through? You know, ask them to share some information, and I'm finding that people are very often skipping to, well, you know, can you give me a job? And if you can't give me a job, can you point me to somebody else who can give me a job? And it's kind of like, dude, I don't know you. You know, it's kind of like, why does that even help you? So even though the path I took, you know, 20 years ago is very different than the path that's open to take today, that part is still true. Every single job I've gotten in my entire career except one. No, except two. I've gotten off the strength of a previously existing relationship. Somebody wanted to refer me, somebody suggesting me, somebody calling me because they knew me, somebody already knowing how I moved and saying, this is the person I need. Mm-hmm. That has been key. That's how you succeed in entertainment. It's all about relationships.
Mm-hmm. So when you decided the Bad Boy thing wasn't for you and you wanted to get more into marketing, mm-hmm. did you have relationships with people at other labels? Like, how did that transpire?
Well, what happened was I left Bad Boy because I had taken I had taken 2 years off from school. I still had to go back and finish my senior year of school. Mm-hmm. And even then, I still felt like, I was in my senior year of school at Bad Boy while I was interning at Bad Boy. And even though I was working at the law firm and I was like, I don't really know if I want to do this, my mind had been set on law school so long, I was still going to apply to go to law school. Mm. So I left Bad Boy because I needed to study for my LSAT. And I knew I couldn't do it and work there at the same time. Yeah. So I left Bad Boy, studied for my LSAT, took my LSAT, went through that whole process. In the middle of trying to do my law school applications, I realized, no, I actually don't want to do it. So I called my mom and I said, I don't think I want to go to law school anymore, because I had a ton of friends who were in law school and really unhappy. Mm. And I said, I don't think I want to go to law school anymore. She said, well, what do you want to do? And I was like, I think I might try to go back to a label or find, you know, at this point, I'm 21, somewhere in there. And I was like, maybe I'll find like an executive administrative position, like get an advertising firm or something. I was honestly still trying to figure it out. Mm-hmm. And going back to relationships, what happened was right about that time, the person who had been someone who had worked at Bad Boy, who I've become very close to, went to an internet startup. She called me and asked me to join her at the internet startup. The internet startup didn't last very long. Mm-hmm. So I was only there for a few months. But then when L.A. Reid took over Arista Records, the head of marketing and the director who I ended up going to work for were looking for, you know, a coordinator in their department. And they were asking around, and they happened to ask, you know, my mentor from Bad Boy, and she suggested me. So it was relationship, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this same woman, anytime I've needed, she's referred me for probably 3 other jobs, another one of which I took, but anytime I've needed a referral, anytime I've needed anything, like to this day, she's one of the first people I can call because she's known me my entire career. And she trusts me, and she knows, you know, what my work ethic is, and again, it's relationship. She referred me for that job, and those two women who I went to work for are also now mentors of mine as well, and have also been beneficial to me as I've gone to other jobs. The music industry, I think maybe in a different way than the corporate sector, is very small. Especially for me being in urban music, it's a very, very small circle. Mm-hmm. And kind of anybody who's accomplished anything knows anybody else's name who's accomplished anything. Mm-hmm. So once you get above a certain level as an executive, they all kind of know each other's names. So it's important to be able to say, oh, I worked for such and such, and that person be able to call them and then be like, no, she's great. She's amazing. You know, as opposed to it being, oh my gosh, she was terrible. We had to let her go. She's a mess. You know, it's so important. It's so important because it's almost, your resume is great. Being able to say what you accomplished is great. But really what's going to happen is people are going to pick up the phone and call somebody and say, what do you think of this person? You worked with her. How do you feel about her? What was she like? Whatever, whatever. So again, relationship is really key.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like also don't burn any bridges, like, you know.
Not burn any bridges.
Yeah.
Ever. And a perfect example of that is that when I left Columbia Records, I resigned. So I left on my own terms and had no idea at that point that, you know, a few years later, I would be working on the management side with John Legend, who is a Columbia Records artist. Had I left Columbia Records on bad terms, when I had to come back and work with that same team again on the other side, it would have been difficult, and it would have been tense and a disaster. But it was easy because I was still in good standing with everybody.
Wow, that's great. And it sounds like at least, you know, you were still able to take care of yourself and leave on your own terms. But again, like, respect the relationships and keep the relationship solid, which is huge. And I think you're right. It's like, some people kind of miss that key element, you know, about relationships.
Yeah.
And I think some people are just like, fuck this, you know, and like,
yeah.
And well, it's like, you got to think down the road, man. This isn't, you know, it might be instant gratification, but.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people look at stories of artists or executives or people who form their own label. And they're like, but they did it by themselves, or they just did it with their people, or they just did it with whatever. And there's always somebody somewhere who gave you some leverage.
Mm-hmm.
You never get it all done by yourself. Or once you get to a certain point, there's some point at which you need to be able to pick up a phone and call another person.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I think there's just this thought of there being shortcuts. Like, I want to be able to get, if I can get in the room with this person, there's this element of this person should be able to quote unquote put me on. Like, if I can just get in the room with this person, they'll be able to hook me up. If I could just get in the room with this person and they just give me a shot, they'll be able to give me a job. Meanwhile, you have no idea what these people's overhead are. You don't know if there are, you know, what the salary caps, if there's, you know, if their positions open. Like, these people run businesses, you know, they don't just necessarily hire people just out the blue off the street just because. So there's still a process. And I've had a couple of instances where there are people where I really liked them and I wanted to help them out, but they were a little too pushy and it turned me off, you know.
Yeah.
Or there was one case where a young woman came, she interviewed with me, she showed up. First of all, she'd been trying to get a meeting with me. I wasn't able to schedule a meeting with her and she just showed up.
Mm.
And she had the same name, she had the same first name as someone else, a brand partner I was working with. So when security called me, I was like, yeah, let her up. But it was this girl. And I was like, well, we didn't have a meeting. So that first of all, was really annoying. And then, you know, we met, she left, and she emailed me later. And I mean, we were sorority sisters, but we didn't personally know each other.
Mm-hmm.
She emailed me later and says, I'm like, hey, I'm looking for a job at such and such publication. Can you email me some of your contacts there? Not, do you have contacts there?
Ooh.
Not, would you be willing to, but just can you email me some of your contacts there? And I just never responded.
Yeah.
But things like that happen more often than I really, you know, it's kind of, it happens a surprisingly often amount of times. I'll say
mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. I wonder, this is funny, I mean, a little bit of tangential, but I wonder too, I think people have kind of been spoon fed this idea, like not just in music, but entertainment of like, you know, these sort of fantasy stories of like, I just walked in there and as soon as they heard my CD or as soon as they saw me, they were like, you're the one.
Yeah, as soon
and
as they realized I wasn't going to take no for an answer.
Yes.
You just
yes.
have to be, yeah. And people have, I agree with you. And I think people have also mistaken persistence for annoyance.
Yeah.
The higher up the food chain somebody sits in a company, like the busier they are, for real, for real. So it may not even be that they're trying to blow you off. They literally may not have time for you.
Yep.
So that's where you have to be flexible. Can I take you for a coffee? Can we have breakfast? Can I email you a list of questions and you send them back to me when you get a chance? You have to be flexible. And a lot of people are just like, it's very, can I pick your brain? Can we go to dinner? Can we go to lunch? My time is valuable. An hour of my time is valuable.
Yeah.
I have a lot of them. If I'm going to use one somewhere, I want to use it on something that I want to enjoy, or give me reason to use it on you. So yeah, like I said, it's a little bit tangential, but I really do think when I talk to younger people who are aspiring entertainment execs about, you know, my path was very much nonlinear.
Mm.
Almost none of it was on purpose. It wasn't in, like, my path didn't become intentional until maybe 10 years ago. And by then I was already almost a senior executive, but until then it had kind of really been kind of accidental.
Mm-hmm.
But all that said, the thing that carried me through and the reason, I mean, obviously I do good work. That's important, but also just maintaining connections with people as I grow along the way. And that doesn't mean just hitting them up when I need something, but also trying to help them when they need something, or just checking on them. How are you? How are your kids? How's this going? I haven't seen you in a minute. Let's get up. Let's, you know what I mean? You can't just be like, hey, I need this from you. And that's the only time you reach out to somebody. And it has to be mutual. As you grow your career, if there's somebody who's helping you, when you can help them, help them. When mm-hmm. you have a contact they need, give it to them. You know, so you have to make sure there is that it's mutual, that there's give and take. And I just think the mutual aspect of it and the authentic, organic aspect of it is something that some of our aspiring executives are losing sight of as they're trying to get in the door.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you were right, too, talking earlier about social media, that it's this sort of false sense of intimacy that, you know, gives the impression of like, yeah, come on up, just come up and talk to me, or, you know, like,
right,
just send me a DM and I'll totally, like, you know, get you a career kind of thing.
Right, exactly. I'll get you a whole career. Just DM me.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about marketing. I think that that's so important. Sure. For artists, you know, whether you're trying to get signed or you're trying to be independent. And I think a lot of artists aren't realizing how crucial marketing and promotion is to their career. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Marketing really is the core of everything. It, not even just the music, but it, any kind of branding, any kind of sales, any kind of anything when you're trying to communicate messaging to the public. And with music, especially music and entertainment marketing is unique in that, like, for example, it's very hard for music marketing people to switch over to corporate marketing because the way we do our job is so different. Corporate marketing is all data sets and numbers and research and analytics. And some of music marketing in that is that, but more of music marketing is just straight creativity and trend following and gut, I guess, if you want to put it like that.
Yeah.
And I think that as people are looking at what jobs they want to get into in entertainment, people often confuse marketing and publicity. So publicity, how can I explain? So marketing is messaging. Marketing is crafting the brand identity if the brand is meaning a product or if the brand is an artist, because an artist is a brand, they are a product. So it's crafting the brand identity, and it is communicating the messaging for each specific project and product. So when I'm marketing an artist, I'm not marketing the whole artist. I'm marketing whatever the thing is that we're working on at that time. I'm marketing this album. I'm marketing this song. I'm marketing this music video, et cetera. Publicity is about the person themselves and about exposure, about helping get their story out there and about telling their narrative. Whereas marketing, so if publicity is about the person, marketing is about the product that this person is attached to.
Oh, that's a great distinction. Yeah.
Yeah. So publicity is the artist telling their own story in their own words and promoting whatever they're doing. Whereas marketing is the consumer messaging. It's like the third person crafting of messaging about the product and the story instead of the artist speaking directly to a publication. This is whatever messaging we build around it. Marketing also is about placement, where you see the product, where you see the advertising, where you see the video, what it looks like, what the aesthetics are, what the timeline is, what it's attached to. Whereas publicity is just really about the artist being able to use their voice to tell their story and how that story is shaped. So people see publicists on the right. And marketing is also kind of like an unsung job. People know what A&Rs are because they see A&Rs post on social media. They're in the studio. They're making beats. They're doing whatever. They're known because they signed this person. They know the publicists because the publicists are on the red carpet. You see them next to them. You catch them in pictures and shots and whatever. The marketers are often kind of behind the scenes a little bit, which is fine, but we actually are the people who make the whole machine run. We're the people that, like I said, we're kind of quarterbacks of everything. So we call the plays and we pass the ball off to the different departments. Okay, this is the vision. This is our timeline. These are our goals. Okay, boom. You do this, you do this, you do that, you do that. Break. Everybody go. We make sure everybody, we are the people who communicate the artist and management vision to the rest of the team and translate it into a way that we can execute that makes sense for both the company and for the artist. You know, we make sure that everybody's on one accord. So radio, you're going at this time. Video, we're going at this time. Do you have this asset you need? Okay, these are the talking points. Okay, these are the other elements. These are the da-da-da. And just, it's really your job as a marketer to make sure that everybody has their marching orders and everybody's acting in concert and everybody's aligned and nobody's just kind of off doing their own thing. So, but again, like I said, it's not the flashy job. Very few people are like, oh, I know that person. He was the head of marketing. No, you usually know A&Rs, you know publicists. Sometimes you know radio promoters, but very seldomly do you know who the marketers are. And now, of course, with digital, the digital marketers are also extremely important too, because so much of what we do now with artists is about social media and blogs and the online space. More so than it is physical marketing, like when back in the days when we used to do Snipe campaigns or pass out samplers or, you know, have promo items in different places. Now a lot of it is heavily digital. So that can be everything from your social media, but not just social media. A lot of people think that marketing is just, oh, I just need to do this social media campaign, but it's not just that. It can be social media, it can be partnership marketing. Like a great example is for Stir Fry, Migos did a partnership with BuzzFeed Tasty, and they redid a video for their song Stir Fry, where they were literally in a kitchen cooking stir fry in a wok, and it was beautifully shot, and it was funny, and it was unexpected, and it was the three of them. And it was great, and it made complete sense for BuzzFeed Tasty, but it also made complete sense for Migos and for the song. That's digital marketing, not just a hashtag campaign. You know, even though a hashtag campaign is part of it, but it goes deeper than that. You know, and I think, like you said, some artists who are trying to be independent, they're just like, let me get these retweets, let me post these links, let me post a whole bunch of stuff on Instagram. But you have to be smart about it. There is some data that goes behind it. There is a matter of, like, what's the best time for you to do this? How often do you need to do this? You know, is your hashtag really going to pick up traction? Is there somebody else using a similar hashtag? What are some other outlets that you could partner with to get them to pick up? What are the things you need to post to make fans more likely to see it and retweet it? How can you beat the Facebook algorithm? You know, there's a lot more to it than just, let me post these things and let me get verified. A lot of independent artists just think they need to be verified. So yeah, there are depths to it. And it also always depends on what it is that you're marketing. Not every marketing plan is going to be the same, but in this day and age, content is king. So the more content you have, the more compelling it is, the longer of a shelf life you're able to maintain, because you're hitting people with something new very frequently, the easier it's going to be to market whatever your product is. And it, but it keeps changing. The landscape keeps changing so quickly, and a lot of people in music will say that the past 3 years have been like the biggest change in the music business they've seen in such a short time in like the past 2 decades.
I would just interject real quick and just say that, and I've heard this from other people, is, you know, marketing's an art form. People don't realize it, but it really truly is an art form, and does take an incredible amount of creativity. And not only that, it's like left brain, right brain, because you have to come up with the, you know, the creative idea, and then you have to execute it. So I just think you shared beautifully about that. You really did, you know, just about how much goes into marketing.
You know, you also do have to have, sorry, to your point, there is also right brain, because you also have to know, how much this is going to cost? How do I get this done? What can I legally do and not do? You know, there, you do still have to have some actual business knowledge to pull this off the right way.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you talk about how much the landscape is changing, and what's your insight on that?
I can definitely talk a little bit about it. You know, right now we're in an era where streaming is king, and labels are still learning how to adapt to that. It's changing how they sign artists. It's changing how they handle releases. And it's changing the retail format, because we're in an era right now where a lot of consumers will largely stream singles over buying albums. So what is happening is we've already seen a decline in the physical market over the past 10 years, not even 10 years, even over the past like 6-7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And labels are looking at these streaming numbers. They're looking at what Spotify is doing. I mean, Spotify is really, even though Apple is huge, Spotify is the king of this shit right now. I mean, the Rap Caviar playlist, Tumaan Baca, who runs the Rap Caviar playlist for Spotify, is the most important person in hip-hop right now. Mm. Not a radio programmer, not a label head, not a producer. It's Tuma. Labels are killing themselves to get to Tuma, to get their songs on the Rap Caviar playlist because it's breaking songs, which is kind of amazing that this Spotify playlist is like the biggest and most important thing if you have a hip-hop artist right now. But that being said, labels are still largely run by old white men, and they tend to look at like the simplest formula. So they're like, okay, well, everybody's streaming this. Let's just sign these artists to single deals, and let's just put singles out, and let's not worry about albums. But what happens with that, that is sensitive to me working with album artists and career legacy artists, is that there's an entire segment of the buying audience that's kind of being, of music consumers that's being left out of everything that everybody's thinking about in the business right now. And those are older consumers, like older Gen Xers who have not completely adapted to digital. They still listen to terrestrial radio. They still want to go buy physical albums. They aren't really, they might be on Facebook, but they're not really on Instagram. They're not really on Twitter. And they haven't converted all the way to digital music. For example, my mom uses iTunes, but my mom takes her CD and puts it in iTunes and puts it on her iPod. She doesn't actually buy stuff off iTunes. And there are a lot of people like that. I know some people my age. I'm 41. I know some people my age who are like that. They don't really do Spotify, or even me. I'll do Spotify for playlisting. I don't use it as much for music discovery. And I think that that music consumer is completely being kind of moved to the side, and it's creating a bit of a cycle. So brick and mortar music stores, which means like dedicated music stores, have been closing for the past decade. Target and Best Buy and Walmart are now the biggest music retailers. But for them, music is a loss leader, meaning they don't ever really make a profit off of it. They carry it, but it's not a key segment of their retail picture.
Yeah.
So it's in a section that's way in the back. There's not really a prominent profile. If it's a really big artist and a Target exclusive or something, you may find an end cap over by the checkout registers or something, but you're never going to get but so much positioning in the store. So now Best Buy's about to pull CDs from their stores. Target will probably follow behind very quickly, and Walmart probably soon after that. So you have a whole segment of consumers that don't know when the album comes out because they don't see it, they can't find it, because now most labels will only do digital advertising because TV advertising is expensive as shit and digital advertising is cheaper. But this consumer doesn't see digital advertising like that because they're still watching television. So it creates a cycle, because then like they're not buying the album because they don't know the album's coming out. So then the album sales are lower, which means that the next time around they're gonna put less into it. And it's hurting, like I said, it's just hurting a whole music buying segment. And that's what I'm worried about. I'm watching that, and I know a few entertainment executives who are watching labels signing these artists off of buzz tracks and singles without really giving thought to like, all right, is this artist still going to provide output for you in 5 years, 6 years? You know, you're burning through these deals a couple of years at a time because it's who's hot right now. Instead of saying, I'm going to sign this person so that we can have like a career artist with us for, you know, a decade or longer. So that's my old person's take on it. That's my old person's take on the energy, on the industry. But at the same time, it really is fascinating to see the innovation and to see now there being a handful of artists that are forcing the business model to change to fit them. like 21 Savage or Lil Yachty, these guys have really actually forced the music business to shape to them, to lean towards them, because they were really just changing the way people do stuff. And I mean, it started with Drake. It started with this era of mixtape artists, Kendrick, who were creating J. Cole, who creating such a buzz on their own that people had to change the way they do business in order to catch up with them. And I think that this newer set of artists, like, they don't give a fuck about an album. They'll just drop a single here, a single over there, put it on SoundCloud, put it up here, put it up there. They don't care about publishing. They don't care about any of that because they make all their money off of touring and merchandising. But that leaves the label scrambling because the label is usually making money off of album sales, single sales, and the artists aren't really concerned about that. They're concerned about their tour numbers and their merch numbers. So I think it's interesting to continue to see how things are changing. And now we have new companies like Steve Stout's new company. And I think there's another new company whose name I can't think off the top of my head, but even Spotify is about to position themselves this way. They're about to offer themselves a distribution outlet for artists who have no interest in going to labels, but need to be able to actually have some sort of real distribution on streaming platforms. They don't need CDs pressed and cut. They don't need anybody to put physical product in retailers, which used to be necessary. They just need somebody to help them put their stuff on a streaming platform and give them positioning and maybe walk them through the stuff they need legally in terms of like publishing and all that other stuff. But that's it. So I really don't know what that's going to mean for major labels over the next decade or so. It's going to be interesting.
Well, I just, God, your insight is incredible. And I think, too, it's so funny. I just interviewed somebody who pivoted from pop to jazz, and she was saying, you know, this is like a whole different demographic that, you know, we were saying, like, is so, it's like criminally underserved. And ironically, like, you know, they have disposable income. Like, they're willing to drop 20, 30, 40, 50 bucks, you know, going to a theater, you know, performance or $20 on a CD kind of thing. And it's what you're saying. It's so interesting. It's like, what's going to happen when there's this vacuum of like, you're right. Like, they're not on Twitter every second. They're not on Spotify every minute. They don't know when a new album is dropping or whatever. So that's huge. I mean, I don't, do you have any, Naima, do you have any ideas to fix this?
I've been trying to figure out, like I said, the fact that I've worked with John Legend, the landscape changed so much in between John's last album and this album. It was really challenging. There's a whole segment of his original fan base who had no idea John's now out.
Wow.
And you know, we wanted to fuss at the label, we wanted to fuss at whatever, but a lot of it is just about the nature of the business right now. And you know, the label is playing a very tight, labels used to play pretty fast and loose with budgets in a way they just can't afford to anymore. So, you know, they're looking at what's economical. I'm like, run a TV spot. But a TV spot really is an astronomical amount of money, right? So it really is hard to figure out, like, how do you now adapt to this new business model but not miss your but not miss those fans. And what a lot of artists are turning to right now is just relying on touring, because even if fans don't know your album's coming out, they will know when you're doing a show. They'll find that if you're attached to some kind of music festival or, you know, some kind of bigger tour event, that they'll find, and they will buy the tickets. They will come out, and it's just about like having your album anywhere you can get them, making sure your merch store is up to date. Like, you have to do so much more of it yourself now to make sure you're getting at your fans and connecting to them, and that they know what's going on. And I think the other thing that really is a challenge when you're speaking about artists that serve older demographics, so you may call them hot AC or urban AC or jazz, all of that, is that a lot of record labels, major labels at least, they are focused on the stuff that's going to sell and sell quickly. So they're focused on what's at pop, what's at rhythm, what's at those formats that really sell singles without thinking so much about what's selling albums. And so it's almost reliant upon you to think of new and creative ways to make sure that your album is out there.
Yeah.
So, you know, that means making sure it's at every tour stop, making sure it's on your merch store, you know, just fighting all kind of ways, especially now, like I said, these retailers are going to start pulling their albums out. And the other thing, and I know I'm kind of skipping around, but the other thing to me that really hurt physical album artists and physical album consumers is when the Universal record release date changed to Friday.
Oh, wow.
Because, yeah, and I'll tell you why. When it was Tuesday, you had the whole week to just promote your shit, right? Mm-hmm. So it started with on Monday. Like, you had the build-up on Monday. Tuesday was album release day. You might have an in-store signing. You're doing TV. You're doing radio. And that whole week, that whole sales week, you're on TV. You're on the radio. You're doing promo. You're shaking hands, kissing babies, the whole nine yards.
Mm.
Now, your promo starts on Thursday because your album drops on midnight. You do whatever you do on Friday, and then Saturday and Sunday is dead. There's
yeah.
no radio. There's
yeah.
no TV unless yeah. you're doing Saturday Night Live. So you have, like, this whole period of this dead air,
mm.
and you got to kind of hope to pick it back up on Monday, but then you only have to Wednesday to really get your sales numbers in.
Mm-hmm.
I think it just, for an artist who has a largely physical audience, it's a killer. It's a complete killer, and I get it. There's no way around it because there are so many territories that were already doing Friday releases, and with the expansion of digital, it was harder and harder to keep, like, if the album's out in whatever, Canada or Europe, it's harder and harder for digital to keep it from making its way over here between Friday and Tuesday.
Mm.
So they had to do it that way. I kind of wish they moved everybody else to Tuesday
right.
instead of moving us to Friday.
Yeah.
But I think just from a promotional standpoint, again, if you're a digital artist, if you're a Future or a Drake or even a Beyonce where you have a really rabid, engaged fan base or a Jay, it doesn't make a difference. But if you're an artist who really needs that whole week to plug and get your message across to your fans and do all that other stuff and to do it at a time where as soon as they see you on the radio, there's an album they can go out and pick up, it's a killer. It's
yeah.
really a killer.
Wow, that is, Jesus, that's amazing insight. It's such a good
yeah.
point. And I always am just like, oh yeah, Spotify's got its Friday. I don't mm-hmm. even think about it, but that's incredible to know sort of the backstory and how that has deeply cut into artist sales, et cetera. So I want to talk to you forever and ever, and I can, and I really, really, really right. want you to talk about music sermons. So, and I honestly
sure.
don't know how you find the time to do this incredible work, but can you tell our audience about it?
Either. So Music Sermon is I guess the best way to describe it, it's a weekly Twitter series that celebrates, the underrepresented, the unsung, and the kind of forgotten artists and subgenres of R&B. And we focus specifically, I joke that we're a B2K centered ministry, meaning before 2000, because I noticed that the beginning of 2000, and this is a whole nother conversation, was kind of the beginning of a decline in R&B specifically. Even right now, you see reports that urban music is running the charts, but that means hip hop. It doesn't really mean R&B. And even though we're having a little bit of a resurgence, but even in the R&B conversations about the 80s and 90s, it's usually just Janet, Whitney, Mariah, Sade, Prince, Michael,
mm-hmm.
New Edition. And there's just so much more to it than that, especially in the 90s alone. So I started completely by accident over the summer around the 25th anniversary of Mary J. Blige's West Before 1-1. I kind of fell down a rabbit hole. Again, I am a passionate music lover, so I go down my own music rabbit holes all the time. And I kind of fell down a rabbit hole of 90s videos. And I was thinking about just how hard we used to dance all the time for everything. And I did a thread that was called We Dance Hard as Fuck in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why everybody was home on a Saturday in July, but apparently everybody was home. And it went weirdly viral.
Mm-hmm.
I was amazed, but it led to, you know what? We also need to talk about this and we need to talk about that. So I did another one about Queen Latifah, MC Light and Salt-N-Pepa, because I noticed also when people are talking about female rappers, they only go back so far as Lauren, Missy, and Kim.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did that. And then I was like, oh, we need to talk about Uptown Records. Oh, you know what? We need to talk about Babyface. Oh, if we're going to talk about Babyface, we need to talk about Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. So at the time, I really thought I only had maybe 2 months of this in me. By about the third week, I kind of fell into the kind of sermon theme, because I think with Uptown, I said something like, today I'm going to preach from the book of Uptown Records, blah, blah, blah. And I did the same thing with Babyface. And I was saying to my friend, I got to call this something, because it was such a collaborative thing the way all this came together, because one friend said to me, you should put these in moments so people can find them. And I was like, you know what? You're absolutely right. So I started putting them in moments. And when I started putting them in moments, I said, I need to call these something so that people know what they are. And by this point, I had decided I was doing these on Sundays. And I said, oh, let's call it a music sermon. She was like, oh, I love that. So that's where the music starts. That was maybe like the third or fourth week. It was a music sermon.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really only thought, and I was actually saying to people, okay, I'm not going to become the thread lady, y'all. There's maybe a few more of these to do. And the next thing I knew, it was like October. And then it was November. And then it was December. And then like Ava DuVernay was responding to them. And, you know, I was about to hit 10,000 followers. And it was just, the way it grew was so insane. And again, all of it was completely by accident. But once I realized that once I saw the response to it and how much people love it and how engaged people are in it, it really is the love I get from everyone else and seeing how much everyone else appreciates them, enjoys them, and learns from them. That's what keeps me going, because there are definitely some Sundays when the last thing I want to do, I mean, my prep time for these things is usually at least 2 hours, and then it usually takes me a minimum of 3 hours to get them out.
Wow.
So it really is my whole Sunday. Or on a good week, I'll start on Friday so that by Sunday, all I really have to do is just do the sermon. And there are some Sundays when I really don't feel like it, but I go ahead and power through it because I want to be consistent. But I have to say it's been the most delightful accident I think I've ever had. I really love them, and I really am humbled by the trust that people put in me to deliver good information to them. Like, people really come to me and ask me questions about music and about artists and about, hey, you know, Naima, what was such and such and such? And I'm like, y'all, I really, for half of this shit, I go to Wikipedia, you know. But it's funny to me that people really, I mean, the 90s stuff I know, but as I started reaching back to previous eras, yes, I research it, but it's like, not all of this is stuff I just know. Some of it is stuff I really do research for the sake of music sermon. But the fact that people trust me and they love me and they show up every Sunday and they encourage me during Super Bowl, when the suggestion came up by somebody to do Janet Jackson Appreciation Day and that went viral, the number of my congregants or sermonites, we call them sermonites now, the number of my sermonites who tagged me in that, I was like, because I didn't want to do it. And I was like, fine. I'll do Janet Jackson Appreciation Day, you know, because I was going to watch the game. So, you know, but it's kind of an awesome responsibility to have. And now we are, for your listeners who aren't familiar with it, if you're not on Twitter, if you are on Twitter, you can follow me live. It's at Naima, N-A-I-M-A, and I do them every Sunday. Or there is musicsermon.com. I created the website over the holidays because Music Sermon was becoming bigger than Twitter, and I realized that there wasn't a way for people who weren't on the platform to easily be able to experience it. So you can go to musicsermon.com. I archive every sermon there after I do it live. And you know, in August or September, I started doing playlists for every sermon. So that also allows another level of engagement. Right now, we have this March Madness 90s R&B tournament going on, which is insane. And we're going to start doing more off-platform stuff this year. So my goal is probably podcast next, but eventually soon we want to be able to do events. So it'll probably, the first will probably be a party, but we eventually want to do panels and talk about the state of music right now. We eventually want to get to a point where we do concerts. We want to do things that, we want to make this an experiential brand eventually, and that's the goal. So we're hoping to start seeing that happen this year.
Oh my God, I have no doubt. And I love it so much. And that's how I discovered you. And I was all proud to like introduce it to my boyfriend. And the way I described it to him, I was like, well, she's a musicologist. Like she's an archivist. Like she's the work I see you doing is that you're basically, preserving. And so it's like, it should be a college course in my opinion. You know what I mean? Because it's like you're preserving and supporting. Yeah, absolutely. A lot of these artists that have been kind of like pushed out of the spotlight or sidelined or, you know, just a good old, you know, the passing of time, but people forget and they just think like, oh, they don't like, I love, and I'm like, I don't know how she does this, but like you go, this sample, you've heard this song because it's sampled and these songs.
Right.
And I'm like, holy shit, how did she know that? You know what I mean? Like you just have so much information, but I think it's really important to, for people to know, like, look, especially with music today, you know, and I'm in my 40s. So it's like, I totally feel you when somebody's like, oh, you know, this artist had this song. I'm like, don't you know what that sample's from? Or don't you know what that melody's from? It's from like 30 years ago. You know?
Yeah, there's no context. And preserving it. There's no context. And that really is what this became, was me wanting to tell the story of this music and these artists in a way. The only other platform I know that's doing it is TV One's Unsung. And TV One is not on every cable carrier, and it's a much older demographic.
So yeah, I don't know anything about it.
So if you ever watch it, TV One does this show called Unsung that literally is about unsung artists in urban music. And it's kind of like it's a little bit of a docuseries, but imagine Music Sermon, but a TV version of it is very much that. And so a lot of people have said, this is like Unsung with Twitter, even though mine is maybe a little lighter in spirit. But, you know, there are people out there who are making sure that our hip hop stories are being preserved, and we're going back and talking to those artists, and we're telling those stories. Nobody's doing it with R&B, and maybe it's because people didn't think R&B needed it for a long time. But R&B is becoming a lost genre in a very real way. Mm-hmm. And even now with it coming back, like with Bruno bringing back like that New Jack Swing feel, with this last album, again, there's no context. So I want to be able to provide the context. And the biggest joy I've gotten from Music Sermon is actually when it's my younger followers who had no clue about any of this shit, who are like, oh my God, this is a sample? Are you kidding me? This is a sample? And Lin-Manuel Miranda gave me a huge shout out at the beginning of Black History Month, saying that he had learned more about the Black music he loved following me in a month than he had like in school and period. And again, that was just reaffirming the fact that like there's a need for this. People clearly want a space to talk about their favorite artists, to talk about the memories it invokes. The March Madness bracket is further proof of that. People are like arguing all in good spirit, but like really fighting over their favorite artists and why they should be winning this tournament. And I'm like, clearly there's a place, people needed this kind of place and this kind of space or this kind of outlet to really just celebrate, to celebrate the music and the artists that they love.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad too that you're taking it off platform and that you're developing it, because again, I think, you know, we can't lose this invaluable information and knowledge and these artists. And you're probably reviving careers, or at least like getting more checks in their mailbox, which is, you know, a beautiful service, you know?
Yeah. I want to really be able to get that. And I want to thank you. The more people like you recognize what it is, and I'm able to talk about it and kind of quote unquote evangelize, because it's Music Sermon. it's really helpful. And the other thing that's really been great, I just have to shout out the followers again, because it's as successful as it is because everybody really just got on board with it. Mm-hmm. And it's so funny to me how, you know, the people that call me pastor, the people that have declared themselves members of the deacon board, members of the trustee board, members of the usher board. You know, everybody really goes along with this whole concept in a very real way, and they bought into it in a really real way, and it just makes it so much fun. Like, it's, it's so much fun. I really do love it, and I really do enjoy it.
No,
and again,
I'm
all by accident.
So glad. The best accident to happen. And again, I just think, you know, you're doing God's work.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you again so much. Again, it's at NAIMA on Twitter for Music Sermon. Yeah. Please follow, share, tell
or
your friends.
Follow the hashtag Music Sermon. Yeah, you
That's
can also,
right.
if you just use hashtag Music Sermon, you can find us as well, or MusicSermon.com.
Right, MusicSermon.com. That's right, the website. Thank you so much, Naima. It's just been
Thank
such
you, Ariel.
A pleasure.
I really appreciate it. This was great. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Again, so grateful that Naima took time out of her insanely busy schedule and God's work to come and share with us such incredible insight and knowledge all about the industry. So I hope you got a lot out of that interview. And again, make sure that you follow her on Twitter at NAIMA or go to MusicSermon.com. And you will be so happy that you did. Okay, this ends another wonderful week and another wonderful interview of, hey, how'd you get that music job? Make sure that you tell your friends, anyone who's trying to get into the industry, trying to figure out, how do I get a job in music? How do I start a career in music? You know, just come on down and listen to. Each week we have great guests that will just give you great insight and share their experiences and so much more. Again, we can be reached at musicjobspodcast.com. That's musicjobs with an S, podcast.com. We are also on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And I am your host, L. Ariel, and you can reach me at lariel-music.com. That's lariel-music.com or at L-A-R-I-E-L Music on Twitter and Instagram. And again, just have a wonderful, wonderful week full of love and productivity and promise. And again, we're going to just keep on hustling. We're going to pursue that dream, and we are not going to give up.